Very good to be with all of you. I would invite you to open your Bibles to John chapter 10, which is the text from which that hymn was based. When we walked into the building tonight, Maria was talking about how cold the building was, and I told her that the hot air was going to be blowing pretty soon. And that's precisely this moment right now. What Josh was saying about my background is a lot of the genesis of these lessons. When I became a Christian and I was 19, my mom and dad were printing out articles from atheist websites and leaving them on my desk in my bedroom about why you can't trust the Bible, things like that. So I grew up in Minnesota, and I go down to Nashville after getting married, and I train to preach there. And then I go out to California, and I'm preaching there for 4 years. And in California, I had a lot of Bible study opportunities with people who knew they weren't Christian. They wouldn't claim to be Christian of any kind. And so when I thought about coming to Atlanta, and we decided to move to Atlanta, one of my biggest fears was that everybody in the South thinks that they're a Christian or they're already religious in some way, and I really have a passion for trying to help people who know they're not Christians to think about the Lord. So I started a meetup group where it was specifically targeting studying with atheists in Atlanta. And Danny Campbell was one of the people that would come with me to all of those studies. And Danny and I had lots of discussions and dialogue with skeptics that lived in the Atlanta area. And I learned a lot with in all of those studies. And so what we're going to be doing tonight is framing what we're doing for the weekend. And I just want to ask by show of hands, and a lot of the things I'm going to be sharing are things that Danny and I studied with the people that we met at that Kroger, because they had a place that you could eat in there and all that kind of stuff. You remember that? We started at a Chick-fil-A, and they did not like that because of the like religious kind of connotation. And then they were okay with Panera. I don't know what's wrong with Panera, but then Kroger is where we ended up. I want us to start in John chapter 10 to frame what we're looking at. Look at John chapter 10, starting in verse 10. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. And the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. In this context, Jesus, I think, is saying some words of critique about the religious leaders of the day. Remember back in John chapter 10, the chapter right before this, when the man born blind is healed, and the Jewish leaders have all kinds of problems with that, and then this gets into John chapter 10 about the good shepherd, and Jesus is the good shepherd that's going to give you life and give it abundantly. And if you're not following Jesus, if you're following anything other than Jesus, what does this text say is going to happen to you? Things are going to be stolen and killed and destroyed in your life. Now, in the context, I think you'd be talking about the religious leaders of their day, but the promise would still be the case that if Jesus is not your shepherd right now, there are things being stolen, killed, and destroyed in your life. Everybody's guided by something. And life under the good shepherd is one that is filled with abundance. We live in a world, and we'll see this in just a moment with some of the statistics that I'll show you. We live in a world that's becoming increasingly secular, less and less people becoming interested in Jesus and his things, which means there's all kinds of people around us that are not experiencing an abundant life the way that Jesus means it. And I want to show you, as we get into this, just some statistics that apply to the United States. These statistics are not about other countries. In 2019, Pew Research did some research, and they found that in the United States, decline of Christianity continues at a rapid pace, and they came up with a couple different categories of the religiously unaffiliated: atheist, agnostic, indifferent. Now, I'm curious by show of hands, how many of you have known people who you used to worship with who now identify as atheist, agnostic, or just indifferent about religious things. Raise your hand if this is most people in this room have known somebody like that. In 2019, they found that in 2009, that was 17% of the United States population. In 2019, they compared the years, and that jumped up to 26%. So one in four people that you run into would say that they're religiously unaffiliated in some way. So then in 2021, Gallup did some more research, and they said less than 50% of Americans belong to a church. And they said this in it: the decline in church membership is primarily a function of the increasing number of Americans who express no religious preference. People that just don't have any interest at all. You zoom forward one more year, Pew Research said that if recent trends in religious switching, people leaving Christianity and being interested in nothing, if that continues, Christians could make up less than half of the United States population within a few decades. And of course, that's the broad way of talking about Christian, if you understand what I mean by that. How many of you, by the way, the current trends right now, it's kind of stabilized a little bit. It's still decreasing, but not to the same rapid amount that it was in 2022. So how many of you are scared? Everybody scared right now? That religion is on the decline and all that sort of thing? If you were to ask this question, why do you think there's a rise in skepticism in our culture? Some people might point to the media. Some people might point to podcasting. People might point to just generally the social pressure against being interested in religious things. But here's another way of framing the question. Why would a skeptic say that there's a rise in skepticism? What would they like to present themselves as the reason why this is happening? How many of you are familiar with Richard Dawkins, famous atheist writer kind of guy? And in one of his more recent books, he said this: outside Western Europe, where only a minority nowadays are religious, most people around the world still do believe in a god or gods, especially if they aren't well educated in science. What do you make of that quote? Do you notice any kind of like snootiness to what he's saying? You know, yeah, most people in the world, they believe some kind of god or gods, especially if they aren't well educated in the science. In other words, the reason for the rise of skepticism is that we're enlightened and we know better. Like, we used to need religion to explain certain things that science has come along and explained. And by the way, you Christian people, you have emotional reasons for your belief. You don't like the thought that you might not ever see grandma again, so you want to believe in an afterlife. And so you have all of these emotional reasons for your belief in God, but we're all Spock, and we've just learned enlightened thinking, and you guys are still in the dark. This is how the modern skeptic would like to present himself or herself. I'm enlightened. Now, I want to poke at that for a moment. Whenever we would do these studies with people in Atlanta, I would find out pretty quickly that this isn't actually the driving reason for skepticism. Do you suppose that people could ever present themselves as one thing, but there's actually something else going on that they wouldn't just be honest about? I'm going to show you, I think, what are the three most common reasons for skepticism. If we were going to try to diagnose this, one of the things that Danny and I would do when we did these studies is everybody would sit around this table and we would get to know each other's background a little bit as we got into the studies. And I'm going to give you three things that kept coming up in one way or another. And I'm not saying that every skeptic fits into all of these categories, but all of these categories in some way would likely apply to a skeptic. Here's the first one: a desire to sin. By the way, before I go through these reasons, remember the skeptic would like to present themselves as totally reasonable and rational, and that's why they don't believe. All these reasons we're about to look at are emotional in nature. First one is desire to sin, and I'm not saying that every skeptic fits this category, but let me give you a quote from an atheist named Aldous Huxley, and he said this: For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness. Now, before I keep reading, do you know what he means by the philosophy of meaninglessness? We're going to say more about this tomorrow night. But the philosophy of meaninglessness means that there is no God who's assigned meaning to my life, and so I can do whatever I want to do. So this philosophy that life is ultimately meaningless was essentially an instrument of liberation. The liberation we desired was simultaneously liberation from a certain political and economic system and liberation from a certain system of morality. We objected to the morality because it interfered with our sexual freedom. What is it that he's saying? Well, we didn't like the Christian worldview because of the sex ethics that it taught, that it's one man, one woman for life, and that's it, and we don't like that. So do you think if you could talk to Aldous Huxley, if he was alive today, that he could have some really sophisticated-sounding reasons for why he doesn't believe in the Bible? And do you suppose that we as Christians might get distracted with all of those intellectual-sounding arguments and never actually get to the jugular, that it's that you want to justify your sin. That's why you're doing this. And all these other arguments are a smokescreen. I'm afraid that sometimes our conversations actually don't go deep enough, even if they seem very intellectual. Let me show you where this is happening in the Bible. Look at 2 Peter chapter 3. This was from the scripture reading. But in 2 Peter chapter 3, I want to point out something that's happening in verses 3 and 4. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 and 4. Knowing this, first of all, that scoffers will come in the last days with scoffing, following their own sinful desires. They will say, I want to follow my own sinful desires and do whatever I want to do. Wait, sorry, that was the NIV. Just kidding. Look at verse 4. They will say, where is the promise of his coming? For ever since the fathers fell asleep, all things are continuing as they were from the beginning of creation. You got scoffers here, and what do scoffers do? Well, they scoff. They make fun of things. They say, yeah, the Bible and God and final judgment day. Look at the argument that they're making here. Ever since the beginning of creation, everything's kind of stayed the same. So you're saying one day in the future, there's a God, Mr. Big God in the sky, is going to reach his hand into the world and do this big judgment day when he's never done anything like that before? That sounds pretty intellectual. But what's driving the argument in verse 3? Following their own sinful desires. I'll tell you the time when I first realized this. Samantha and I were in Nashville, and before we were going to move out to California, we did a final like 3-week vacation back to Minnesota to say bye to everybody there because we were going like way away from everybody. And there was one of the guys at the church up there who had been converted at one point and then fell away. And he wanted to meet with me at a coffee shop and just talk about what was going on in his life. And we sat down and he goes, yeah, so I'm not sure that I believe in the Bible anymore. I said, so why is that the case? And he said, well, you know, there's a lot of things about the New Testament manuscripts, and I'm not sure that the manuscripts are really totally reliable and all this kind of thing. And there was just something about the way that he was talking that seemed off. And so I asked him, I said, there's really good answers to all the things that you just brought up, but I have a question for you. Is there anything the Bible teaches that you don't like? And he said, well, yeah. And it was something that dealt with morality. Guess what we talked about for the next hour and a half? It had nothing to do with the manuscripts. But what if we talked for 3 hours about the manuscripts? Would we be getting to what's actually going on? People like to feel sophisticated. They're not just going to say, I want to do what I want to do, but here's this other thing that maybe can distract you and make me feel sophisticated in my unbelief. This is first reason for skepticism. This one doesn't apply to everybody, but we'd be naive to say that it never applies to anybody. Here's another one. Bad religious experience. Whenever we would do these studies in Atlanta, we would say, okay, what's your name, and all that kind of thing. And then the second question that we'd ask is, what do you identify as? not like gender-wise, but what do you identify as religiously? And so, you know, there was like Ashkan, and I'm a former Muslim, and now I'm an atheist. And then we go around and everything like that. And when you get to the second question of, tell me about your religious background, people got real emotional. Suddenly people would start talking about some of the frustrations that they had and some of the hypocritical things that they had to grow up with. Have you ever known somebody who walked away from the Lord's things because there was some kind of a hypocritical experience that they had with another person at church? I think all of us have probably known somebody like that. There was a time when I was at a Starbucks in California having a Bible study with somebody, and there was this guy that was like at the high top tables next to me. And I was going through some book of the Bible with one of the guys that was a member of the church there. And this guy that was at this high top table kept looking at us. And he was looking at us like this. And I was like, I think that means he's mad. And so, you know, like that. So I look over at him and I go, and he looks at me and he goes, guys, can you please take that outside? I was like, take what outside? Like the get that Bible and the talk about God out of here. And I was like, well, sir, we're going to finish our study. And so we finished the study, and every now and then I'd catch him going, you know. And so the study ends, and the guy that I was studying with leaves, and I go up to the guy and I say, did you have a bad religious experience? And we talked about his hypocritical dad, who dragged him to church all the time and did not live it out at all in his own life. Have you ever seen the theme in the Gospels of the crowds? How the crowds, especially in the Gospel of Mark, become a barrier to people. Do you remember when Mr. Paralyzed Man in Mark chapter 2, he's being carried by these four friends, and Jesus is in this house preaching the gospel to these people, and the four friends like get to the house, and they realize that there's no way they're getting in this house, at least the conventional way. Can you imagine being one of those four friends? If I'm one of those four friends, I'm going, you know, my arms are already pretty tired from carrying you, however long this has been. And I kind of think maybe we can catch Jesus tomorrow somewhere else. But somehow they had this conversation. We're like, well, I got a good idea. How about we go up the roof and unroof the roof and then drop him down in front of Jesus? And they go, actually, that's a pretty good idea. Let's go ahead and do that. They had to overcome the crowd to get to Jesus. Do you remember when Mrs. Bleeding Woman in Mark 5 has to excuse me her way through the crowd and touch Jesus' garment? I can name other times in the Gospels where there's people that have to get past the people that are crowded up around Jesus, and evidently the people crowded up around Jesus are not as noteworthy as the people who get past the crowd. But there's a lot of people that have had a bad religious experience, and they can't see past the crowd. Do you think knowing that this is one of the causes of skepticism ought to give us some compassion, though, when we do talk to people? I'm sorry that that happened. I'm sorry that that elder treated you that way. I'm sorry that that preacher treated you that way. I'm sorry that those kinds of things happened. But that's another emotional reason. Here's a third emotional reason for skepticism. Just social pressure. Can you imagine living in the 1500s? And maybe you live in Germany or something, and you want to walk around the streets and go, I am an atheist! Do you think you would do that? Nobody would do that, because everybody back then believed that there was some kind of God or gods or something like that. But we live in a society now where it's more common to be okay not believing these things. You ever known anybody? How many people do you know that have started to make bad decisions in their life because of peers? They started, you remember like in sixth grade, the transition between sixth and seventh grade, where there was like the goody two-shoe kids in sixth grade? And then that summer happens, and then seventh grade starts, and then suddenly these kids are like smoking stuff, and you don't even know what they're like. How did they get involved in all of this stuff? It's tied to bad friends. I remember when I was in eighth grade, this was the time of my life where I believed that Jesus was a made-up figure. But you know how like a lot of people in their living room, they've got like a big TV that they all crowd up around? I had a friend who, they were such nerds. The mom was like so good with computers, she worked with computers. And so rather than having a big TV in the living room, there was five desks in the living room. And each kid would clack, 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 clack on their computer. And all the kids had these chairs that had the the wheels, you know, those cool chairs that are fun. And so somebody would clack, 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 clack. Hey, look what I found. And then everybody would take their chairs and go like this. What'd you find? And so it was just like everybody was making sure they don't hit each other and kind of stuff. And one of them one time pulled up a bar graph that showed the more educated you are, the less likely you are to believe in God. And we're like, that's right, because stupid people, sorry, S-T-U-I-P-I-D people, believe in God. Yeah, sorry. Sorry about that. That those kind of people are the ones that believe in God. And so we're like, yeah, that's because we're enlightened and we know better and all that sort of thing. So imagine that you've got people that these are the kind of people you associate with. You ever wondered why more highly educated people are less likely to believe? Maybe it's because their cohort thinks it's ridiculous to believe it. And it's not really because they're enlightened, but it's because of the peer pressure that they have. And then there's parents and all. So here's my question. And here's what we're going to do for the rest of these lessons now. Would all of you agree that that's a pretty fair assessment of causes of skepticism? And there's probably more that we could add to this list. These are the most common that I've seen. Here's my question. How do you reason with people who want to appear totally reasonable, but there's actually emotional reasons for the things that they're saying? And I want to express two different approaches that people can have and have had about skepticism. I think both approaches are good. I think both approaches have their own place and time. But I'll tell you that the first approach is the one that I think Christians use most often. And we're going to talk about the second approach in the coming lessons, but I want to flesh out this first approach to make sure that we all understand what we're talking about by this. How many of you have had apologetics classes? Where like you're looking at all, and objective evidences for the faith are just things that can be verified, that we look at the archaeological evidence, we look at the arguments for the faith, we can see all of that, and it makes sense to me. And you remember when Jesus, after he had his resurrection, Acts 1:3, he presented himself alive to them after his suffering by many proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. Do you remember what some of those proofs were? Oh, Thomas, you doubt. Well, you can touch my nail-scarred hands and side. And by the way, the text doesn't say, I don't think Thomas went up to Jesus and was like, well, okay, let me touch your side and like, let me see if I can put my finger through that hole in your hand. Well, I guess you are Lord and God. I think it's just like the invitation to do it was enough for him to make that great confession in the book. But Jesus is giving many proofs. There's many proofs we can give. Why does God exist? All those kinds of things. Let me give you some examples of what we mean by this kind of thing. There used to be people that would argue that David was no more a historical king than King Arthur. Have you ever done this kind of study before? Where you trace back like archaeological evidence and you find out that skeptics used to say such and such, but then archaeology proved that the skeptics were wrong, and then the atheists had to make different arguments. I love these kind of things. So this was something that one atheist said. But then in 1993, there was this obelisk that was found. Don't you just love it when they find obelisks? And this obelisk says this: I slew mighty kings who harnessed thousands of chariots and thousands of horsemen. I killed the king of the house of David. This is a pagan king writing this, that they had destroyed a bunch of people from the house of David. And once that was found, they stopped making the argument that David wasn't a historical person. That's an example of an objective kind of argument for the Bible, and I like those. Here's another one. When I was in college, I had this, you know, if you have your dorm room, you can like put a poster on your dorm room, whatever. This is what I had on my dorm room. It's a flow chart that argues for the existence of God. So let's see how this works. The universe. Would all of us say that the universe exists? Unless you're a solipsist. And solipsists say that nothing actually exists, but I've never met a real solipsist. Huh? All right. So the universe exists, and so either the universe had no beginning or it had a beginning. It used to be the case, a lot of people believed that there was no beginning. And now people believe that there is a beginning. So, all right, cool. So the universe exists and it had a beginning. What caused the beginning? Was it nothing or was it something? I would go with the something, personally. So we have that one. And then either that something was non-personal or it was personal. In other words, something caused it, and it was either a non-personal accident or it was some kind of personal being causing these things to happen, which then would lead you to God. And so that's an argument that somebody made in the 1300s that I think is a pretty good argument. All right, so here's a question, though. You could spend 13 weeks studying apologetics, studying all these good arguments. And what they do, I think, a lot of the time, is bolster our faith. And sometimes they help skeptics. But have you ever learned these kinds of things and shown them to a skeptic, and it was like two ships passing in the night, and there was no way that they were still going to see what the truth was about these things? This would be because a lot of the arguments people have against God in the Bible are not purely rational. There's still emotional things going on. So you could show somebody things like this all day long, but if they still have emotional reasons for their unbelief, are these objective things going to move them? You ever tried giving somebody a really reasonable argument about something and it's just like nothing's getting through? What if there was another approach where, yes, this has value, this is helpful, but what if there was another thing that we could talk about with somebody that might hit the deeper thing that's going on? And this is why we started with John chapter 10. Jesus is the loving shepherd. If you don't have Jesus in your life, you don't have an abundant life. The second approach to approaching skeptics is what we could call subjective evidences. And I know sometimes people get kind of scared when they hear the word subjective, and here's all that I mean by this. Christianity resonates with our deepest longings and needs, and we can subjectively be persuaded to see this in ourselves. That if we start with the premise that God is our creator, and therefore he knows what's best for us, if I go against what the designer of my life has said for me, and it's bringing about ruin and devastation. But I can be told that this God actually, when we do the things that he's told us to do, is what's best for me. That's a different kind of discussion. And think about, can you think of any times where Jesus appealed to people based on not, here's all these objective things to consider and to believe, so believe me. He would do that sometimes. But can you think of any times where Jesus would say something like, look within yourself and realize that there's something lacking in your life, and then know that I'm the only source for this in your life? I'll give you one passage right now. Do you remember when Jesus is talking to the woman at the well? Whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. He talks about living water in this passage. He's talking to the woman at the well. What was the lifestyle of the woman at the well? One man after another after another. You ever seen anybody just destroy themselves seeking romance? Like they're putting all their eggs in that basket. And Jesus doesn't say, well, actually, you don't have the right to be married because of, you know, this, that, and the other thing. He says, if you want your thirsts quenched, you need to come to me. Which begs the question, well, what kinds of thirsts might somebody have that could only be fulfilled in Jesus? Now, because we've got so many lessons for this weekend, and there's a couple other things that we want to do with two of the lessons. If you think about this question, which worldview fulfills your deepest needs? And we ask, okay, well, what are some of my deepest needs? I think I need to have a need for meaning. I would like to know that my life counts for something. Pretty hard to live life abundantly without ever having any sense of meaning. What about having hope? What if I don't have any sense of what's going to happen to me after I die? When I say hope, I don't just mean like, oh, I hope the economy turns out okay, or I hope that I get that new Cybertruck because they are the coolest cars around right now. Like, you're talking about after you die, what's going to happen? And everybody needs to live with some kind of hope if you're going to have an abundant life. And so what we do, what we're going to do, and what Danny and I did when we did these studies, is I would clip a bunch of quotes from atheists. And I would say, this is how atheists try to find meaning in life. This is some problems with that approach, and here's what the Bible says about meaning in life. This is how skeptics try to find hope in life, and they have ways of trying to figure these things out. You got to read what they say, though. This is how a skeptic would try to find hope in life. Here's some problems with that, and here's how the biblical approach satisfies our deepest meaning, our need for hope, or whatever the specific thing is. You could make this list longer of different deep thirsts and needs that we have, and do that same exercise. And as you do that, you're asking the question, which worldview fits my deepest needs best? Is it the secular worldview, or is it the Christian worldview? Which worldview gives me the most satisfying kind of hope? Is it the Christian worldview or the secular worldview? And if you can help somebody see that Christianity is beautiful and they should want it to be true, then you can start showing them the objective arguments. And that it'll be more palatable to them at that time. But let me say this. As we look at these lessons this weekend, this is not just an evangelism weekend. That's part of kind of what we're doing. But how many of us here are not actually getting our meaning from God? How many of us here are not actually getting our hope in God? And maybe there's been some ways where the secular ways of trying to get these things have seeped into our heart, and all of us need to be challenged about the same thing. Does this approach prove Christianity to be true? It doesn't. But it makes it more compelling. Maybe it can be used as a proof for Christianity. Imagine for a second that you were walking through a jungle, and you found a baseball glove. And you put the baseball glove on, and you go, well, it fits my hand pretty perfectly. This must have been designed by somebody who understands how hands work. What if you find a worldview that fits how it seems like human beings are? Would that lend itself to, well, maybe the designer of this worldview is the one who created everything? Or as C.S. Lewis said in one quote, creatures are not born with a desire unless satisfaction for those desires exist. A baby feels hunger, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim, there is such a thing as water. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. If you can poke and prod people and think, you know what, you need meaning in life. How is your sports fanaticism doing that for you? You need a sense of hope in your life. How is your addiction to the news and politics giving that to you? Do you not realize that if you're not being shepherded by Jesus, things are being stolen, killed, and destroyed in your heart, and it's in your best interest that this is true? There was a few years ago where I had talked to somebody who grew up in a Christian family, and his father was an important member of this church in this place that he grew up in, and he was struggling with his faith. And so the father wanted the son and I to connect, and so we were on the phone, and he brought up this thing that really troubled him about the Christian worldview. Like, why would God create a world where there's so much pain and suffering and all of this kind of thing? And my first question back to him was, what have you been doing to try to find answers to that question? And he said, well, I tried talking to one of the members at the church probably about 4 months ago, and he didn't really have any good answers, so that's kind of where I'm at. But he had prefaced the conversation by saying, I've been struggling. I've been wrestling with this question. Okay, have you ever been in a wrestling match? It's exhausting, and you know that you're wrestling. All right, so if you're going to use the word wrestling or struggling, I want to ask you, what have you been doing to find answers? Because wrestling is pretty difficult. Well, I talked to one person 4 months ago. That's not wrestling. That's not struggling. People have been asking questions like this for thousands of years. There's lots of YouTube things you could find, books that you could read, lots more people that you could talk to. You know what was actually going on? Was a desire to justify doing what he wanted to do. Is there anybody here tonight that you say, I've been struggling with this or that? I don't know the answer to this or that. And it sounds intellectual and it sounds sophisticated, but actually, if you're honest with yourself, there's some other things going on, and the deeper discussion are your emotional barriers to belief. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk about how Christianity satisfies our need for meaning. And then Sunday morning, we're going to talk about how Christianity satisfies our need for hope. And we're going to have the Sunday morning class, we're going to talk about how to navigate some of these discussions. And then Sunday night, we're going to end by looking at Pontius Pilate and how he caved to the crowds to try to, he gave Jesus over to satisfy the crowds, and how we do the same thing today as an emotional appeal to try to fit in with the world. But for now, we're about to sing the song, Jesus the Loving Shepherd. This song is designed and intended for us to sing right now to get us to examine our own hearts and our own convictions. If there's anybody here tonight that's not a Christian, that you've been allowing yourself to be shepherded by all kinds of other things in this world, you know that it's not satisfying. You know that life is not feeling abundant. If you're somebody who has been serving the Lord, keep doing that and encourage everybody around you. You don't know tomorrow if you're going to live. You don't know if you're going to make it home tonight. Right now, you're in a room filled with people that would sacrifice hours to talk to you about the things that matter the most. If there's anything that we can do for you, please come forward while we stand, while we sing.